ear, bass on your ear. Take your iPod, your iPad with your HD display. Connect them to the cloud so your data's up to date. With your tablet in the air, play some solid game. Log into Facebook, tag a photo you can share. Tweet your plans, and play some Angry Birds now. Come on, baby, tell me who's the nerd. Nerd up. Everybody say, grab your GPS and get up on your Segway. Nerd up. It's a way of the world. No matter where you are, you got a 4G signal.
It's time for the Nerd Up Podcast, and here's your pod hosts, Guilty Wilson. Nerd Up.
All right, welcome back to another episode of the Nerd Up Podcast. I'm Guilty Wilson.
I am Eric Billingsley's Android.
Yo soy Tim Coker.
Muy bien. I am Tim. Gone mad.
I love introductions. Anyway, yes, we're here to talk nerdy with you, and towards the end of the podcast, don't forget we will give our Twitter addresses, even though... Tim just gave his, actually, and I just realized that. We're all going to let you...
Sneaky like that.
You are. You always want to stay in contact with us because it doesn't matter any time of the day. If you send me an email and you say you want a prize, I can find one for you because I think I've got one copy of Summerhawk left. That I've got some video games, or no, audiobooks. No, I got rid of the video games. Audiobooks, and I think I got a couple board games, too, to give away. So if any time you ask for a prize, you'll get one. And remember, at Gil Wilson, that's me. Haha, stuck mine in, and Eric, Bill, you don't get to do yours. Although I just did. But
wow.
And then,
this is a professional podcast, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah, by someone's standard, I'm sure. But yeah, we're here to talk nerdy. We're going to talk about all the regular things we always talk about. And we've got a little bonus feature towards the end of the podcast. We are going to talk about a certain animated feature that we all watched. We're going to talk about that. Tim Coker's going to tell us why he loved it, and we're going to say, Tim, you're a knucklehead. Or wait, hey, wait a minute. How's that on the Weekend Update? Yeah, I'm going to start mine with, Tim, you ignorant slut. Because anyway, we'll all have our...
When I was a kid, I thought he was saying slot. Slot.
I'm the sloth.
Oh, we could all claim that, I think. But anyway, so we'll be ready. Let's first talk about the beginning of every single podcast, television. And, you guys, I'm going to let you guys start. Does someone want to talk about anything in particular in the television world?
Hey, let's talk about our old favorite, Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.
Oh, yeah.
Woo. Oh, yeah.
Here's my opinion.
Uh-huh.
I think the season should have ended on episode 20. I do. I think that was a perfect ending for the season. Everything was up in the air, and I was ready for season 2. The last episode, I think, was superfluous. I think we're building up. We only have one more episode to go, and I'm not sure what they can do in this last episode that's going to be a better close than we've already gotten.
Yeah, that would have been a great cliffhanger. That definitely would have been a great cliffhanger. But I'm anxious to see. I mean, they brought Maria Hill in, and I'm anxious to see Nick Fury make his little short appearance. And hopefully it's not just a little picture like they showed on the teaser.
Yeah, I noticed that.
But hopefully it'll actually be him moving his lips or something. But I'm anxious to see how they do close it. Only because you're absolutely right, Tim, that should have been the season cliffhanger. If that wasn't the cliffhanger, I'm almost like on edge to find out what is or what will be.
You know, Tim, I'm going to, like, if anybody says anything more insightful than that during this show, like, I'm going to clap my hands for him because that was really good. I didn't realize why I was kind of feeling the way I was during this last week's episode, but you hit it on the head. And it isn't that this episode wasn't good. I thought it was really good. There are questions I have about it, but emotionally, I think I could have stopped after the last one, and they could have booted this material to the next season. I didn't mind seeing it, but yeah, the emotional high of that last episode, I don't know how you beat that.
Well,
yeah,
I'll jump in here and say
like
that
it feels like a coda.
I think it's character development, and you usually get that early on in a season. Now, I'm still willing to wait and see what happens in this last episode. I think they can make this last episode pay off. And like you said, Tim Coker, it's a good episode. I enjoyed it, but it's very much just from beginning to end character development for Agent Ward. But yeah. I think it's possible that they may make it pay off in a big way in this last episode. But if they don't, then Tim Matson, you're right. They should have stopped at a high point, like, you know, at a cliffhanger, even though cliffhangers make me very frustrated, but that's you know, that is the way of things, and especially with the superhero story, you kind of expect that. But we'll wait and see what happens.
I don't know that it was necessarily really a cliffhanger. I felt like the story had a very, very natural ending in episode 20. I mean, S.H.I.E.L.D. has completely crumbled. Everything is basically reduced to a shambles.
Yeah.
And now the question is, where do we go from here? And I worry that they've started to answer that question with just these last two episodes. Whereas I think the answer to that question deserves an entire season.
Yeah.
And I don't want them to try to answer that question in two episodes.
Well, right. So that's why my hope, honestly, from what you're saying as well, is that I hope that we find out that there's actually more to it. You know what I mean? Not that they're trying to answer the question in these last two episodes, but that they're trying to make the question even more question-y. You know, I don't know if they're going to raise it a little deeper or whatever. I just said raise it a little deeper.
Wow.
Dig up, stupid.
Well, if you went raise, R-A-Z-E, then it makes a little sense.
There you go.
Thanks, Eric.
Good save.
Your check's in the mail.
I don't know. It's going to be interesting. Like I said, like Eric said, it was a, you know, pretty much a backstory, which they could not tell the backstory at any other point during the season, though. That's one thing. It's Ward's backstory would have totally ruined this for us. Even the movie Captain America would have given us a little bit too much of a heads up. So,
but they could have saved it till next season.
They could have,
unless it has something unless it ties in very deeply with the season finale, which is what I'm thinking. I'm hoping anyway.
No, but I'm totally on that with Eric. I think this should have been saved for the next season because I don't want Ward brought back in the fold quickly. I'm sure he will eventually be brought back into the fold.
I
totally do. There's no way around it. They are not setting this character up to just be a villain for a season and then gone.
Well,
he's one of the major characters. You will see him brought back into the fold. He will be the element of the team that is on the edge and that you don't know if you can trust. He'll be dangerous. But he'll be part of the team again. Mark my words. No. He will be part of the team again.
I am marking
now. Like Jane on Firefly.
Yeah, you can put that on. You know, this is May 10th. Tim Matson says Grant Ward will be part of the S.H.I.E.L.D. team again.
15:24 Central Time. So, all right, got that written.
Exactly. But the thing is, I don't want that to happen quickly. I want them to have to earn it.
Right, I agree with you.
Something else that I don't want to see happen too quickly, and I don't think that it will, but is I don't want to see S.H.I.E.L.D. rebuilt too quickly. In fact, I hope the entire next season is them acting clandestinely and acting completely without support. We've already seen them going up against the military. I want to see more of that. I want to see them deep underground and having everyone after them and still trying to do the right thing. You know what I mean? I think that would be a really interesting season.
And how about that military colonel, whatever he was, the senator from Heroes? How about him being a big old
military?
Yeah. That was kind of cool.
Talbot is great.
Yeah, I love it. When he walked in there, I'm like, Senator Petrelli, wow.
Well, and he's a whole character. I don't know if you know Gil, but he's the General Thunderbolt Ross, right?
Right.
He's like the little toady guy that Ross would kind of do what Ross's dirty work, and he was really an obsessive Hulk hunter. So,
I never realized
kinda,
that.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that kind of clicks.
I love that Marvel universe.
I love it. Yeah.
But one thing I'm going to say is that I would be really surprised if they put the ship to rights vis-a-vis S.H.I.E.L.D. in the next season, because given how provocatively they kicked the table over for S.H.I.E.L.D. at the end of Winter Soldier, I think that that's where we should expect to find things at the beginning of Avengers 2. You know, I don't think that we're going to go into Avengers 2 with suddenly Nick Fury's back on the helicarrier and everything's fine.
Right.
Yeah.
Which would be good.
Well,
that would be
a
huge mistake.
I hope that they don't rebuild it quickly. I agree. And let's not forget the other big piece of Marvel news this last week. The fact that they picked up Agent Carter as a series.
That's right.
That's brilliant.
Yep.
I am so excited about that. I can't tell you how excited I am about the prospect of an Agent Carter TV series. First of all, Hayley Atwell is really talented.
Mm-hmm.
Yes,
and
I agree.
Yeah. Quite easy on the eyes. But that's beside the point. I'm very excited about the notion of a Marvel series set in the 40s and 50s, you know, the early days of S.H.I.E.L.D. Nazis are still a thing. You know, it's great. I think that's going to be so much fun.
That's like the first season of Wonder Woman.
Exactly. Oh,
yeah.
And here's another thing. I mean, here's a an action-oriented TV series that's being anchored by a woman.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a great thing. I mean, there are so many great female characters. There's no reason why there can't be a female-centric Marvel show. And it just, one more time, makes you wonder, why the hell isn't there a Wonder Woman film being made?
Right.
What is going on at DC that one of their... The major characters, I mean, think about this. This is a major character, and they can't seem to get a film made.
Yeah, there's always that question.
What about the potential, too, of having, you've got this series that's taking place, you know, during World War II at the, you know, the creation of S.H.I.E.L.D. Think of the potential for all the Easter eggs and the planting of history and the development of backstory. And then, just as an example, the what's his name? The character whose grandfather was a Howling Commando.
Oh, yeah,
sure.
We can actually see that character developed and see the link. And I mean, there's just so much potential there. I'm excited, too.
Yeah, which brings us back to the Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. I love that they brought back the old suitcase of the old Howling Commando's tools.
That was so fun.
That was a blast. I mean, especially the little joy buzzer, and they put it to great use, too. That's just so cool.
That was boss.
Yeah, I really love how, like, one of the things I love about this show, and even when the show would suck at times during the first half of the season, one of the things that I would return to as kind of a consolation was I loved how not cynical it was,
mm-hmm.
and how not cynical it is. Even in a show where, you know, you see the rug of the establishment just get pulled out from under it, and you find out that there's rot everywhere, and yet it's still not a cynical show. And what I'm getting at with this is Fitz's reaction to Ward's betrayal and his refusal to give up on Ward. I really find that touching. Like,
yeah.
it gets to me as a viewer, and I know that he's just an actor reciting dialogue, obviously, but
right.
I'm emotionally invested enough in the characters that I buy Fitz's devotion, his friendship, and his refusal to believe that friendship wasn't authentic. I think that's just great, and I one of the things that keeps me coming back to the show is that faith in humankind, that idea that people are complicated and things are complicated and you shouldn't just, you know,
yeah.
I don't know, I'm running out of words, but I just really love that.
Tim Coker, thank you for putting that so succinctly. That is, I didn't realize that was a real reason why I love this show, but you are totally right.
Well, I knew that was why, but part of the reason that I think that the first Avengers movie worked so damn well was because it worked so much as a counterpoint to The Dark Knight, which is very cynical and dark and just kind of ew, you know. I mean, I do like the movies, the third one not so much, but this was completely the opposite. It's full of hope and idealism, but not in a cheesy kind of goofy way.
Right.
It's in a way that you can actually identify with and say, okay, yeah, I can buy into that. And I think that also goes into Agent Coulson's character, and I think that is a key element to why he had such a falling out with May when he found out that she was, you know, keeping tabs on him, because, you know, he is such a hopeful, and he always sees the best. I don't know. I love the character of Agent Coulson. I mean, he is so positive. He always sees the best possible outcome. He sees the best in people. And for someone on his team that he was so close to doubt him and to think that he might be unstable and that he might, you know, give in to despair or whatever, it hurt him deeply, because that's not him. And for someone close to him to actually think he might do that really did injure him deeply. I totally bought that whole rift between him and May, mm-hmm. and also, you know, connected to the whole thing with Fitz's reaction to Agent Ward. I love that conversation between May and Sky, in the hotel room afterwards, where, you know, where she's explaining where she's coming from and why she feels so betrayed, and then we find out from May that she feels betrayed too, but she's not going to waste time showing it. She's going to take it out on Ward when she finds him.
Right. Yeah, she's going to frustrate the crap out of his face is what she's going to do.
Well, and I've got a pivot there when you talked about May. Is, like, one of the things that a good friend of mine would complain about a lot early in the show, and I confess I got a little irritated with it too, was just May's being such a wet blanket pain in the butt all the time during the first part of the season, and how she was no fun. Did any of you guys notice how different her character was in this episode now that there's not a secret between her and her old friend Phil, and now that she's not having to be the keeper of this dark truth and that it's open between them. Like, did you see how much more relaxed her character is?
Yeah.
And how her, she's kind of having more fun with it. I perceived that, and I thought it was a really nice touch by the actress.
You know, and actually, it's kind of like the change between Michonne in Walking Dead, where after they all are on their own, all of a sudden Michonne's a nice person. It's like same thing with May. All of a sudden, May's a nice person, and it's because that stress is gone. She didn't have to hold it anymore.
Yeah.
And I thought that was, perfect portrayal on screen as well.
I think the actors really deserve commendation. As the series has gone on, they've really kind of settled into these characters, with the exception of Clark Gregg, who I think really from the get-go seems to live in the skin of Phil Coulson.
Yeah.
His performance is so unmannered. It's so natural and everyday.
Well, he had a couple of movies to rehearse that with.
I agree. But going back to the very beginning, I think that's one of his strengths as an actor.
Yeah,
is his ability to just live in that character and just be, you know, very nonchalant and very everyday about his mannerisms and performance. I think he's quite a strong actor.
It's really great when you can watch an episode and not realize you're watching actors. That's what makes it good. So,
but it's interesting though, in the first few movies that you saw him in, he really came off as being kind of a bureaucrat, kind of a downer, and it's like, okay, you know, he's the guy who enforces the rules and blah blah blah. And it really wasn't until, well, I think you saw a little bit of his human side and his character got developed in the Avengers, but it really wasn't until this show till you realized just who his character is and what he's about. And it's not contrary to those earlier portrayals. It's just you didn't know who he was at that point, you know?
Earlier talking about the Agent Carter series, has everyone here seen the Agent Carter one shot that they made? It's on the Iron Man DVD or Iron Man 3 DVD and Blu-ray.
No, have not.
Have not.
Excellent.
Yeah, you can look at that as like the pilot for the Agent Carter series. It kind of sets up how she got from A to B as far as B being S.H.I.E.L.D. Yeah, it's fun. It's really fun, and it'll give you a taste of what this is like. So I just wanted to throw that out there for folks that want to get an idea of Agent Carter on her own.
Yeah, cool.
It's out there.
Totally recommend you watching that. And one other little tiny note on this before we close up. It's also worth noting that Howard Stark is also a potential, member of this TV show.
Yeah.
He's mentioned in the literature where they're talking about the TV show. It hasn't been confirmed whether or not he's going to be in it or not, but I would think it would be odd if he isn't. So
yeah,
there's another little nod back to old school Marvel.
I'm loving that they're doing it. So they're keeping the world infatuated with Marvel, and that's a good thing.
Yep.
All right, let's go on to another show. Supernatural. Did you guys catch the last episode? Anybody besides me?
Don't care.
Oh man.
Still on season 5.
Oh, you still need to catch up, I guess. So
for season 6.
Well, they're continuing. I mean, I'm not sure what kind of a cliffhanger they're going to have on this one. They revealed Crowley's son. Let's see here. Crowley took him out of the timeline, which could be some consequences there. I'm trying to think of some points without giving away too much. I know that they finally defeated Abaddon, so that's going to make things interesting, because now what do they got? All they got left is Metatron. And no, not the Transformer. That's Megatron. Keep that in mind. But they're going to get Metatron. There's a line in the in there where they're talking about Metatron, and I think it's Sam says, "What, the Transformer?" So it's a lovely little tie. But there's also a couple of references in this latest episode to pop culture that just really shine, make you realize what that show is capable of. Not only are they, you know, great storytelling, great writing, and you know, you got some fun stuff, but they also can have a little jovial side. So, but once again, we've only got like one or two more episodes left of that as well. So we're gonna see how they always end on a great cliffhanger at the end of every season. And Kripke said that, you know, he's only going up to season 10, so only one more season of this. We'll see what happens. Okay, let's see. Arrow.
Still not. I'm still waiting for the end of the season. I'm going to watch it all at once.
Totally not really Arrow, but I can't wait for the new Flash TV series. I want to see how they do that one. That ought to be fun.
Yeah.
And I mean, I know it's going to be tied in with Arrow, but I can't wait for the. I want to make sure they don't ruin it. Although
I don't know, man. I got to say, I'm really, really cautious on that one. I mean, TV budgets are so tight.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they really are. They have to work on a very small scale budget. I just worry that the effects are just going to look cheesy.
Well, hopefully they don't try to do too many effects.
I already think his costume is a little cheesy, so I don't know.
Well, you got to admit, though, the original, even the Flash in the comic books, his costume's cheesy, if you ask me. I mean...
Oh, no, no. I'm totally down with that. I agree. I'm just saying, once you try to bring that into the real world and make it look like it exists in a real world, man, that's hard.
Yeah.
Without it looking really super cheesy.
Well, do you remember the 90s series of The Flash?
Oh, yeah.
Now, the whole thing there, I don't know what it was about that one. I mean, Dick Tracy movie with Warren Beatty, the color schemes they used throughout it. Primary colors only. That's what they kind of tried to do with the 90s series of The Flash. And mix that in with the special effects they tried to use with his running. It didn't work. I like the idea of the primary colors in a comic book format, using that as your lighting and everything else, set direction or set decoration. But then they tried to make him look like he's running fast by doing some blurred, and that like modernized it. And so with this new season or the new series, I'm hoping they don't go that direction. I don't think they're going to go, although Arrow is full of primary colors, green especially. Everywhere you look, everything's green. I'm hoping they don't make everything red, you know? You see what I'm trying to get at?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
So I'm hoping that, at least for the scenery and the looks of it, but I don't know. Yeah, it's hard to pull off, it's hard to pull off any spandex-wearing superhero in the real world anyway, so.
I think that there's always that temptation to overly art direct any...
Yeah.
You know, comic book adaptation. I mean, I see where that comes from, and sometimes it works, but I don't think it has to be done that way, and I think that that's just the common misconception.
Right, there's no need to be artistic.
Has the Flash actually appeared on Arrow yet?
Yeah, oh, well, no, not as the Flash himself, but they showed him gaining his powers, or showed how the accident that got him his powers, but they haven't showed him in the costume or anything like that. Yeah, it ought to be, I mean, it's an interesting concept. I'm hoping DC can pull it off on at least the TV series world. They tried it with Smallville, but Smallville just had so many other little problems. I mean, they introduced just about every character in the DC universe. They tried to, anyway, in Smallville at one little point or another. But, and you know what? Here's another thing. I don't know if you guys remember, but back in the late 90s, I believe it was, they had the TV series Birds of Prey, had the Huntress, let's see here.
Oh yeah, I never saw that.
Yeah, I totally
forgot about that.
Yeah, I got it on DVD. I haven't watched it yet, but I watched the first couple episodes. But who was it? Huntress, the Oracle, and
Black Canary.
There we go. Yeah, that's what I was thinking. The Oracle being, you know, former Batgirl, who's now in a wheelchair, and she directed everything. The Birds of Prey, they could do that series again. I mean, from what I saw from the first couple of episodes from the original late 90s series, they did a good job of it. It was pretty good. And it was a good superhero TV show. But they could bring that back easily because they've already got the Black Canary. They've got the Huntress. They just got to, get Batgirl in there and work it out there. So they could bring that back as a series, too. So if DC really wanted to, they could take over the TV market and say, Marvel, you can have your movies. We've got the TV.
Yep.
I hate to tell them, but Marvel's doing the TV too better.
I guess they still have some catching up to do. So especially with the Netflix streaming series that they're going to be doing, Agent Carter, Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. Yeah. Yeah, are they going to rename it? Because we know Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.'s going away. Are they going to rename that series, do you think?
I don't think so.
Uh-huh. Oh, I doubt it.
I don't think it's necessary to.
That'd be interesting. Former Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.
Yeah.
Clandestine.
Formerly known as Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.
Yeah. It's going to be just a little symbol thing.
Yeah.
Just on a purely technical note, I mean, that would be a horrible idea if they did. I mean, because you're pissing away basically all of your marketing from season one.
True.
Because then you're starting over from ground zero for a lot of people.
Yeah, that's true. They're like, what's this new show? Oh, it's been on it already a season? Never mind.
Exactly. It would do nothing but muddy the waters. It would be a horrible idea.
Yeah. All right. Good point.
One of the shows that I liked a lot, which was Spartacus, changed the name of the show to suit each season, every season, and it just ticked me off. I don't know why it bothered me so much, but I didn't like the fact that every season had a different name.
I never watched the show, so I never realized that. That could ruin things.
Yeah.
Well, all right, let's move on to another TV show. This was actually going to be a short one, too, and I think, Eric Billingsley, you'll be the only one probably talking about it with me. You had mentioned that they're starting a series called Penny Dreadful last time.
Penny Dreadful, yes.
Did you happen to watch the pilot?
I certainly did.
So did I. It was there's a free weekend on Showtime, and I was looking at on-demand Showtime, and I saw Penny Dreadful. I said, oh, yeah, Eric talked about this. I got to watch it. And honestly, I thought it's pretty cool, especially since they had that girl from 300 Rise of an Empire. I can't think of the actress's name, but...
Eva Green?
Yeah, there we go. Thank you. Because they had her is like even more... Plus, you know, of course, Timothy Dalton. I mean, you can't go wrong with him, unless you're doing a Bond film. although Billy Piper was... slated, I think they only had her like for one short little scene.
I didn't even see her in this episode. I didn't know she was in it. I knew she was in the series, but
wasn't she the little girl that they were looking for, or the not really a little girl, but wasn't she the vampire girl that came back? I mean, it was such a fast scene, you didn't hardly see her face. I'm thinking that
could have been her.
Yeah, I'm thinking it could have been her. I like the idea. It's almost like a League of Extraordinary Gentlemen type of idea, where they're trying to recruit Dr. Victor Frankenstein to help them out.
Oh, man, right, let's hope you're talking about the comic book and not that dreadful movie.
Yeah.
Oh, there was a movie? Crap. There was a movie of that?
No, there was not. There was no movie.
But Gil, did you happen to catch that Timothy Dalton's character's last name and his daughter's name? It's Mina Murray.
Yeah, Mina from Dracula. Yeah.
Exactly, yeah. So I saw like a little 15-minute promo piece where they're interviewing, you know, Sam Mendes and the other people who are the creators behind the show.
Oh, yeah.
And they're you know, that's what the whole concept is that they said during this you know, I don't know, 20 to 30-year period, there was, you know, horror fiction just boomed, and there's right. all these great pieces of horror fiction that they're integrating into the same story. So there's going to be Dorian Gray, there's going to be Dr. Victor Frankenstein, Dracula, mm-hmm. but it's not done. I mean, you know, if someone told me this idea before I saw the first episode, I would be really skeptical, and it's like, oh, that sounds kind of cheesy. Now, this is just one episode, and I mean, you know, two or three episodes down the line, I may have a completely different opinion.
But right. Well, you're going to have to keep this
episode. Yeah, oh, I will definitely be watching it, and I'll definitely be reporting on it. But I was very impressed with the first episode.
So was I.
It's just really, I mean, it's very slick. The period costumes and the sets, everything just looks so detailed. I mean, I just was totally pulled in, and I really am interested in the characters. I mean, for a 1 hour first episode, I'm already very interested in the character of, I've forgotten her name, the Eva Green character.
Yeah.
All the major characters are really, you know, intriguing. And they.
Okay, so I'm intrigued. Give me the elevator pitch. What's the story? I mean, what are we watching?
Judging from the pilot, the idea is that Mina from Dracula was taken by Dracula, and so her father wants her back. So he's recruiting all these people to help, and they all have their own special powers. Like the Eva Green character, she is a somewhat of a witch, it looks like. Because she can, they've kind of hinted at it. She reads tarot for sure. Then they recruited an American, Buffalo Bill Wild West Show actor.
Sharpshooter.
Yes, and sharpshooter. And I think I find this one of the most offensive lines in there. She goes, "Well, you can help us hunt these guys down," which are vampires that they're hunting down. She goes, "You can help us hunt these guys down, or you can go on being an actor." So I'm like, "Wait a minute, what's wrong with being an actor?" Anyway, exactly. So, but anyway, so they're recruiting these people to help, and one of the things, and I love the whole conversation that Timothy Dalton's character. He had with Dr. Frankenstein that whenever he's talking about you can and again it's one of those lines, you can go on being a doctor and do it, looking at things, you know, or you can study the difference, and this is the doctor saying that, you know, we can look at all the differences between that moment between life and death, you know, that spark, that quick moment. And it's like, and at that moment, that's when I realized, hey, that's Frankenstein. He's bringing someone back from the dead. So, and he did at the end of the movie, or at the end of the episode. Well,
they had this, the whole crux of that conversation was that, okay, you know, the Timothy Dalton character is this great, renowned African explorer. And he says that there's a mountain that's named after him in North Africa somewhere. He's like, not the biggest one, but not the smallest one either. So he's, you know, his thing is exploring and charting out areas and seeing things that, you know, people haven't seen before. And Dr. Frankenstein, who's just a kid, basically,
yeah.
has this counter argument with him. He's like, okay, you know, you and all these other, you know, so-called pioneers, your idea of innovation is to plant your flag in something and say, I saw it first, or I discovered it.
He goes,
what I'm doing is charting the tissue that connects life and death, you know, and just basically kind of belittles Dalton's character, but yeah. Dalton buys into it every bit of it. It's just an interesting, intelligent discussion between these two characters. So the writing in this show, at least so far, is really well done. Mm-hmm. Everything is really well done. Very high production values, good casting. Even Josh Hartnett, who I'm not necessarily a fan of, but he seems to be everything that this character needs. But yeah, I'm very curious to see where they go with this.
Yeah, so basically, Tim Matson, in a nutshell there, they're recruiting people to go find his daughter. And it just so happens to be a big supernatural battle. I mean, they went into a nest of vampires, if you will, and that's where it started. So, and again, Billy Piper's in it somewhere. I think that was her in a brief moment, but so
yeah, you're probably right.
So I believe Rose Tyler should be, or well, no, Billy Piper. We've got to go by her actor's name. So yeah, so that's the gist of it. Is that they're recruiting people on this hunting. I'm guessing it's just going to be hunting down a certain vampire, Dracula. So
actually, my impression from just watching the promo piece and hearing them talk about it, I think it's going to be much wider than just them hunting for this guy's daughter, although I think that's going to probably be the central storyline, at least for this season. But yeah. I mean, we've seen that there's some, maybe it's vampires, maybe it's some other creature. At the very beginning, you see this mother and this daughter slaughtered by some unknown creature. It probably is vampires, but I mean, they were like ripped to pieces. So yeah. I don't know if it's necessarily vampires or something else. We do know that there are going to be other creatures in the show.
Well, we did have Frankenstein's monster. So,
right. And there's, and like, you notice that, you see some guys reading a newspaper and they're referring to, you know, is Jack back?
Oh, yeah.
Referring to Jack the Ripper.
Yeah.
So I think there's a lot of room and latitude for storylines and side quests and things going on that hopefully they'll take advantage of all of this. I mean, I don't want to see them just throw in all of these characters, you know, for the sake of throwing them in and trying to shoehorn them into this quest to find this guy's daughter. I want to see, you know, the Dorian Gray storyline. I want to see I want to see these characters all well developed, not just thrown in to serve one specific central storyline.
Like you said, during that time period, there were so many different horror stories I mean, that's where the bulk of our horror stories come from, is that time period. Dracula, Frankenstein, H.G. Wells stuff. You know, that's the bulk. That was where everything horror and sci-fi that we now see was based on those origins right there. There's not very many stories that stray from those origins. And I think that's going to be a great tie-in for that whole season.
Well, it sounds promising. I'm definitely interested in that. It is funny, though, because it almost sounds like they really ought to be paying Alan Moore some royalties.
I know.
It sounds really, really close.
Yeah.
Well, the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen.
That's when I was watching this, and basically I didn't know how they were going to do it. And once I saw that they were recruiting people to do this, I'm like, gosh, that's just like in the lead up to League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. They recruited all these horror classics. And it's like,
yeah.
But yeah, you're right. Maybe he's on the writing staff. I don't know. I'll have to dig deeper on that.
No, he's. I just looked on the web, did a little research while you were talking about it, and it doesn't appear to have anything to do with it. But man, it sounds so close.
We may have started a lawsuit for Alan Moore.
Well, I mean, thing is, these characters are in public domain. The ones using are public domain.
Well, see, actually,
bringing them together and putting them together on a quest is pretty similar.
Well, now, you know, I didn't read the comic. I only saw the horrible horror movie. But the movie was definitely an action film. It was a horror film at all. This is most definitely horror.
Yeah, especially when they got in that nest of vampires, and that was some creepy stuff.
Yeah.
I'm going to check this out.
Yeah, it's on Showtime. If I get it, it's going to have to be illegally, so I'm probably not going to be watching it. So,
and if you do have Showtime, it's on, you know, video on demand, because it actually doesn't premiere till tomorrow night.
Yeah.
But they've had it, you know, available for download, and they showed like a preview episode or something. But yeah, I'm very excited. I can't wait to see the next episode.
There's some I don't think they. I think if anything, Alan Moore might owe from them, because the term Penny Dreadful refers to. This is a fuzzy memory I've got on the Penny Dreadful stories. But Penny Dreadful stories are basically, I believe they were like the origin of Pulp Fictions from our early years of in America, where we had those Pulp Fiction magazines. But they were the British version of that, and they used those old monster stories when blended in to tell news stories. And I've heard them referred to before, it sounds like another Penny Dreadful story or Penny Dreadful novel. And I've heard those referenced before. So,
In the promo piece, they referred to the Penny Dreadful as during the Victorian era. It was a lurid weekly or it was a continuing storyline, and it was always, you know, murder was at the front. They were usually very bloody and such. So yeah, it was just like basically it was Pulp Fiction of the era.
And it was cheap, so that it would appeal to the working class people.
Exactly, yeah.
Hence the penny part of it.
Exactly. So, see, we got not only that do we talk nerdy stuff on this podcast, but we educate.
That's right.
Right now I should have a star flash by with a rainbow that says, "The more you know." So, all right, let's move on to something else. Anybody else got any television to talk about? I think, Eric, you might be excited about Hannibal being renewed.
Yeah. I didn't. Thanks for sending me that link. I hadn't heard before reading that it was renewed. And honestly, I wasn't really holding out much hope, because I just, you know, I don't know any other people that watch it. But I looked at the comments, from people on the, who were responding to the article, and there apparently are a lot of other people out there who feel the same way that I do, and that are just absolutely infatuated with this show, and so happy to see that it's coming back for a third season. So, yay!
I kind of feel like that show has reached its like saturation point, where it's got that critical mass of enough people that will be interested in watching this that it can maybe survive. I don't know that it's ever going to reach mainstream success, but I do kind of feel like it's reached that moment where it's doable. It's something that can be a going concern.
From what I've watched, and I've only watched a few episodes of it, but from what I've watched, it's been very, I mean, I've enjoyed what I've watched. It's never been enough to make me, you know, stop everything I'm doing and watch it every week. But when I do, every once in a while, I look on demand or maybe I'll happen to be watching TV at the time it's on. Whatever the case is, I was like, oh yeah, let me watch this again. And it's never been one that make me want to stop everything I'm doing, but I will watch it. I've enjoyed what I have seen.
Okay, guys, I'm going to come clean on this.
Uh-oh.
I honestly think that Hannibal is probably the best TV show that I will never watch. I have no interest in watching this show whatsoever, but at the same time, I acknowledge that it is probably a great TV show. I'll never watch it.
It is so cutting edge as far as the visuals and the way the structure. And I don't know if you guys, I'm sure that people out there listening, that there are Brian Fuller fans, because Brian Fuller has developed and created a lot of very unique and amazing shows, not the least of which was Pushing Daisies, which is still, even by today's standard, just a mind-blowing show and completely unlike anything else that's ever been on television. And if you can, I don't know if it's on Netflix or anything else, but everyone owes it to themselves to watch Pushing Daisies. It was only two seasons before it got canceled, but I guarantee you will thank me for it. But it's not just that. He has developed a lot of shows. He cut his teeth writing on Deep Space Nine and Next Generation, I believe. And then from there, he just started creating his own shows. I can't even sit here and come up with a list, but look him up on IMDb, and you'll see he's got a very impressive resume.
I have to wonder, is this the first TV show that he's made that's made it to three seasons? Pretty much everything he has been involved in has been like lower rated and then canceled. Although I will agree with you. I think Pushing Daisies is a masterpiece. I think
absolutely.
It's a masterpiece of television. And you're right. People owe it to themselves to watch it.
Yeah. I mean, it's just, I can't even describe Pushing Daisies, because it blends so many different genres, and it's so successful at every one of them. I mean, it's a musical, it's a comedy, it's science fiction horror at times. It just and it's the visual palette, the colors that they use to create this thing are it's just incredible. Nothing short of incredible.
Let's moving on from television. Let's talk about movies. Mainly importantly, let's talk about this movie we all got to watch, not together, but we all watched in a conjoined thought process. I don't know what you call it. But we watched, all of our minds got together at one point and said, hey, we should watch this movie. Tim loves it. Tim Coker loves it. We'll let him tell us how great it is, and then we can all battle him. Or maybe not, because I kind of liked it. But it's Batman Under the Red Hood animated, a really cool Batman story. But let's turn it over to Tim Coker. Let him introduce it and tell us what he thought, and then we'll provide some extra thoughts.
Oh, thank you for that lovely setup. I am... all about Marvel. As you know, I'm really a Marvel zombie, but I do love a good Batman story. And I confess I don't read a lot of modern Batman comics because they often kind of creep me out and depress me. You know, like a lot of it seems to be based on a dare to see who can put the most disturbing content in the book, you know? And you know, that's just me probably, but I'm also not really pleased with any of the Batman movies, even the recent ones, because like the serials I've seen, those are mainly a good example of what a bad movie serial like. And, like, the TV show from the 60s is awesome, but it's a really specific take on the character, and it doesn't feel definitive to me at all. And, like, of the movies, I think the original four, like the Tim Burton and whatever, I don't really like any of them anymore. I liked a couple of them when they were new, but now I can't really watch them. Even the Christopher Nolan films, I think, are only about half good. The second one, I think, is better, but that's because of Heath Ledger more than anything about the whole Batman thing. Because I feel like they're all huge. Compromised by things you would expect from incredibly expensive movies, right? You've got iffy casting that, you know, is more to put a famous person in the movie than to find the right person. You've got weak scripts. And in the case of the Nolan films, you've got this constant failure to deliver on the depth to which they really, really pretend. You know, they really act like this is serious stuff. But in the end, I don't feel like they really follow through with it. And I feel like the animated Batman films have been the best because, you know, since they're lower budget items and they're not aimed at a mass audience, they're kind of the least compromised. They have the fewest guys who don't know anything about Batman in the room saying, couldn't you put Jim Carrey in this, you know? So I feel like he feels the most like he does in the comics, right? And that's why I love the animated films. And I think that Batman Under the Red Hood is the one that does it the most for me. And it's not a perfect movie. There are things that bother me about it, but it really does it for me in a number of ways. And I want to just really quickly address these before we get to the discussion. I'll start with kind of the more superficial and then get into the deeper reasons I like it. But most superficially, I think the fight choreography is spectacular. I think that Man of Steel, you know, finally showed us what a real Superman fight would look like. But the Batman fights in the movies are always terrible because Batman is heavily armored, and you've got somebody like Christian Bale or Michael Keaton or Val Kilmer in a heavy suit, and they don't have any gift for fight choreography to begin with. So they look, you know, about as graceful and lethal as Samuel Jackson, which is not very, you know. And what I love about the animated films is that you get Batman is like lean and lightning quick, and it's just like in the comics where the action defies something that anybody but the most skilled stuntman can do, and you don't have to have cutaways to a close-up of Christian Bale going, "Argh!" You know? So I really love that it doesn't take me out of it. And I think in this movie it really nails it because, you know, putting in Batman, Nightwing, and the Red Hood, they've all got kind of a similar fighting style, but I found all of the fights with those three to be thrillingly acrobatic. You know, it doesn't seem like watered down kung fu. It really seems like the kind of organic fighting style that I imagine Batman and company having. So, you know, like when they're interacting with moving vehicles, when Batman jumps through that moving car, all of it I just thought was spectacular. So that's A, right? B is the stellar voice acting, which I just think is great. And I'm a huge fan of Andrea Romano, who's the general voice talent wrangler for DC animated movies. And I think with this one, she really did a good job. I don't think anybody does a chip on your shoulder like Jensen Ackles.
Oh, yeah.
You know? And so I thought he was perfect as the Red Hood. Neil Patrick Harris, you know, at first when I saw he was going to be in it, I thought it was stunt casting because of his geek cred. But I loved his lighthearted Dick Grayson, and I thought it was a really beautiful contrast with this kind of embittered, sarcastic Jason Todd. So you get kind of the good son versus the bad seed. You get the contrast with the different outcomes of these two boys that Batman took in. So I really like those two kind of playing off each other. I kind of wish they'd had more scenes together, the two of them. You know, some of the others, like, I wish Kevin Conroy was in it. I wish David Warner played Ra's al Ghul, but Wade Williams as the Black Mask was amazing. I think in the comics he's enormously unappealing, and on the screen, I found him really, like, entertaining and funny. His shtick of punching out his henchmen just killed me, you know, because he can't hit Batman when he's mad, so he hits his henchmen instead. But I loved John DiMaggio as the Joker, you know. Obviously, he's a hero of mine because he's not only Bender, you know, on Futurama. He's not only Jake on Adventure Time, but everything he's in, he always makes it better. And his Joker, you know, the combination of him and the acting done by the animators, which I thought, you know, when you watch the Joker's face in this movie, I just couldn't take my eyes off of him. I thought it was, you know, just a hair short of as much as I enjoyed Heath Ledger. I loved the humor and the menace. I loved his deadpan commentary. And in the big fight scene at the end, you know, where the dialogue. No, Tim, I know that you're going to tear into the fight scene at the end, but I really liked his commentary because I felt like the commentary between Batman, or the dialogue between Batman and Jason, got a little bit overheated and cliched and kind of pendulous, and I really loved how the Joker kind of punctures it and acts as almost a sarcastic Greek chorus at times in that scene. And I loved his final determination to go down with the bomb and have all of them blow up, and that's what would be a happy ending for him. So I enjoyed that. And kind of just, you know, zooming out to the big picture, it's not a perfect movie. And I find that with comics, you know, you kind of have to take the crunchy with the smooth, you know. So, like, there are bad things, but it's bad in ways that the comics often are. And it ties into a hole that I really enjoy. And it just reminds me of how I process comics. And, you know, some of the best comics have aspects that are mind-bogglingly stupid. You know, there are plot devices and tropes that we just have to live with. And one of them is character resurrection. And that's always, always terrible. I think it's so rare that they do it well. Winter Soldier is a great example of how you could do it right. It's one of the only examples. Yeah. But in spite of how hard it is to do it in a way that I like, you can't stop comic people from doing it. Nobody stays dead except Uncle Ben and maybe Thomas and Martha Wayne, you know? So, you know, I think that, you know, if Jason Todd's death was enough of a statement in itself and he didn't really need to be brought back, but obviously he's going to be, and I thought it was a good way to do it. You know, I liked how it brought in Ra's al Ghul, even though I kind of find him to be a bargain basement version of Dr. Doom. Yeah. I still think that he, well, you know, with some differences, but I maybe it's me as a Marvel guy, but I think Ra's al Ghul is only as good as the comic he's in. He never makes a bad comic better, you know? And he's like Al Pacino, right, with movies. You ever see Al Pacino make a bad movie better? No, he just makes it worse. So, you know, but I liked his role in Jason's death and then his guilt because, you know, Ra's al Ghul has his own perverted sense of honor and family, his guilt forcing him to try to make amends, and how he blows it because he's Ra's al Ghul, I guess. And having him turn bad, Jason, not because the Lazarus Pit drove him crazy, but because it's his honest human reaction to the fact that Batman didn't execute the Joker for his killing, I thought was kind of fascinating morally, and I thought it made him a good opponent in combat too, you know, the connection. Mm-hmm. You have the personal kind of connection with Batman, but also the fact that they're so physically equal. I mean, back to Winter Soldier, I actually liked that at the end of this film, for all the issues that I might have with that ending, I liked that it was just down to Batman versus Jason trying to save him and trying to end this thing somehow well. And I really wish that Winter Soldier had a climax that was as simple as that, because I got a little annoyed with all the bloat at the end of that movie. And I feel like with this, I like that they really boiled it down to just the relationship that matters, which is the three people in that room. However satisfyingly they pulled it off is open to debate. And then lastly, the last scene in the Batcave, I want to call out, because it makes me choke up every time. You know, I read recently that Batman's real core is family, and that he's, you know, either mourning the family he lost or trying to protect the new family he's putting together around himself with the different Robins and Commissioner Gordon and Alfred and everyone. And so, you know, I feel like everybody wants to go dark and everybody wants to do Batman dark. And I like that this is a downbeat ending that for me actually plays. When you know, you see Alfred say, "Do you want me to take this costume out of here?" And Batman says, "No, this doesn't change anything." Mm-hmm. The fatality of that and the determination in that, and then cutting to that scene of Jason saying, this is the best day of my life, and knowing that that is something Batman's going to have to live with for the rest of his life. And then they just cut to the credits. I get really sad every time. That's a lot to respond to. I have one question I want to lead with, and that is that a couple of weeks ago, Eric, you went on a rant about how stupid it is that Batman hasn't killed the Joker and wondered if that had ever been addressed. Now, it's addressed in this movie, and personally, I do not think that they managed to answer that question in a satisfying way. I think that Batman kind of gets his answer out. It's kind of flat, and they move on. And I wish that they would have done more with that in the movie. I'm glad they asked it. It's an interesting question to think about as a fan, but I kind of feel like they were a little bit cowardly about really delving into it. So that's my first question, is how do you guys feel that question was answered in the movie?
Well, I'm going to jump in first here, because what I have to say is short and sweet about this, and especially because I want to hear what you guys have to say. But I will say this. I thought it was the answering that question, I thought they did a pretty good job of it, because it's not that easy of an answer. I mean, it would take almost another new movie to create the answer just to that question. I mean, why didn't you kill him? Because he would win. You know, or no, because that's what he wants. I thought that plain and simple. That's exactly the thing. I mean, sure, there's a lot more depth to the answer, but like I said, another movie would have to be used to answer that.
Good point.
So, but I got a couple points I want to make about this movie. I was with you on Jensen Ackles. I thought he brought a great, like you said, chip on his shoulder type of Red Hood. Now, I got to ask one question. Anybody read DC? Red Hood and the Outlaws, is that the same character in the New 52 run, Red Hood and the Outlaws?
I think it is, but I haven't been reading that book.
Okay, because I've got them digitally ready, but I've been saving all the 52s except for Lanterns, but I've been wanting to read those. So now I'm even more so wanting to read that. But anyway, okay, now I will say, like I said, Jensen Ackles as the Red Hood, I thought, like you said, perfect, chip on his shoulder. But there was one point, they even gave him a Dean Winchester car. When he drove away the first escape scene, that was a Dean Winchester car 100%. And I kept saying, Sammy! But no, that never happened. But I thought that was a unique tie-in. Let's see here. Also, one other little point, a very minor point that I thought, but it happens in every comic book. But whenever they said the name of that big, hulking, cybernetic thing that absorbs powers of superheroes, and what's he called? Amazo.
I mean, that was pretty lame.
How cheesy can you get? I'm like, I almost stopped watching that movie right at that point, and that's right close to the beginning. And I'm like, Amazo? Really?
Yeah.
And then, but then I went on. But that's one of the things I do not like about DC Comics in general. I like a lot of DC Comics, but most of them I can't stand because put an O at the end, he's a villain. Sinestro, Amazo, you know, no, I'm done with it. So. But that's all I've got to say. I mean, I will say that, I thought this is a really unique tale. I love the fact that Nightwing made a short appearance. I wish he would have been in there longer. I think I'm agreeing with you on this one, Tim. I think it would have been nice to see a little more go-between with Nightwing, maybe even helping to battle. I don't know. But the whole Red Hood, you know, once he discovered who he really was, especially when he did the little audio tape or audio recording, you know, you haven't lost your touch, Bruce. And I was like, okay, this is going to be something interesting. So, but yeah, it's definitely a nice little story in the DC Batman world, and it tells a little background and a little bit of a future reference for any of the other comics, especially if that's the same Red Hood in the comic book. So that's all I got to say about it. I'm turning it over to you guys.
I'm going
to
jump in here because I know we all know where Tim Mattson's going to be on this. So I'm kind of square in the middle on this. So
I'm chomping at the bit, guys.
Okay, I'll start off with Tim's question about the whole philosophical deal with Batman and the Joker. And yes, as soon as I saw that part, I was like, oh, this is exactly what I brought up a few weeks ago on the show. And I agree with you, Tim. It was interesting that they brought it up, and it might, you know, if I was a dog, you would have seen my ears perk up at that moment. It's like, oh, they're going to get into this, but they didn't really. They kind of sidestepped it. You know, I mean, Batman gave kind of a pat answer that didn't really fully envelop the whole debate. It didn't really explain where he's coming from, but I did give him points for at least addressing it, at least bringing it up. And as Gil said, it probably would take, you know, an entire movie of its own to really fully explore that. And I would love to see that. If you told me that there is an animated feature that really fully explores that philosophical debate and, you know, both sides of it, you know, I don't need to have any conclusions drawn. I just want to see it fleshed out. I want to see the fact that Batman is really struggling with both sides of this debate. Not like, oh, well, I don't want to sink to the level of the Joker. You know, okay, fine. But, you know, how about all the people that have died because you didn't take the Joker out? Don't you feel any responsibility for that? I want to see those issues addressed.
Well, I was just going to say, you talk about wanting to see a movie that does that. Unfortunately, this was the movie to do that in, because nobody is ever going to have a more valid reason to ask Batman that question than Jason Todd. And he does it in this movie. So that's one of the major fluffs, I think, in the movie, is that they don't embrace that enough.
Yeah, although I could see other opportunities to where this could be brought up, but yeah, it was a great opportunity,
sure.
And they kind of, you know, they kind of let it go. But the story in general, I enjoyed it. I was engaged throughout the story. From the first 5 minutes, I think you'd have to be like brain dead not to know exactly what was going to happen. That, you know, that as soon as I saw Red Hood, I think I know who that is. I don't think there's much question about who that is, but the writers seemed to think that there was this great mystery about who was under the hood and played it out trying to milk it. It was like, no, I know who's under the hood. I mean, if we hadn't seen that first 5 minutes, okay, then it might have been, you know, obviously it would have been a mystery. But the fact that you gave away that first 5 minutes that didn't really have any direct bearing on what comes after the title sequence, obviously that's who's under the Red Hood, you know? So I think that was kind of a misstep on their part. They probably would have been better off to start with the post-credit sequence and then do that in a flashback once Batman realizes who Red Hood is. I think that would have been a lot more effective, because it's really no mystery at all.
That's a really good point.
The actors, I was very impressed with the voice talent that they got. And you didn't mention Bruce Greenwood, and I love, love, love Bruce Greenwood and everything he's ever done. I love him. And here we get back to the new Star Trek movies, but I loved him as Christopher Pike in the new Star Trek movies. And I was really ticked off when they killed him off, even though I knew eventually he was going to have to die. But I love that character, and I love his portrayal of that character and pretty much everything he's ever done. And he was, I thought, a really good inspired choice for Batman. The other casting too, Neil Patrick Harris. I never really had much respect for him over the years. I have gradually grown to greatly respect his talents, and I believe that he could play just about any part that you cast him in. I really think he's one of the most versatile actors out there, but you look at him and you want to typecast him in a certain part. But, you know, that's the great thing about, you know, voice acting, is that he can really fit any role, and he really does inhabit that role, and I loved him in that part.
And he wasn't too bad at Spider-Man either.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he was the MTV series of Spider-Man. He was Spider-Man.
Yeah, he's great, and the fact that he is a bona fide the fact that he is a bona fide geek, it just you know, gives me all that much more respect for him, that he loves to do genre stuff and loves to you know, and this is his preferred medium to work in, and the fact that all just adds to my love for him in Dr. Horrible Sing Along Blog.
Oh, I love that.
If there's anyone listening to this podcast who has not seen Dr. Horrible Sing Along Blog, stop what you're doing, go out and get a copy on Blu-ray or seek it out somehow, some way, watch it. It is amazing and awesome. And and that is the one thing that put Neil Patrick Harris over the top for me. Once I saw that, I was like, okay, he's in my pantheon of great actors now, because he did such a great part in that show. One thing that was just cringeworthy was in those that first action sequence, the Mr. Basil exposition,
And one of the bad guys that's tied up is like, oh, yeah, well, that's
Nightwing.
Oh,
God, yes.
Oh, I know, that's awful.
Oh, yeah. That was, well, that was right at
that
the...
That was terrible.
That was right before the Amazo, so it's like, those two things together is what almost made me put that thing in the trash.
Yeah, yeah, it was pretty bad. I was like, and I'm coming from some, I'm someone who hasn't read Batman comics. So, you know, I mean, I didn't really, I mean, I know kind of who Nightwing was. I knew that he used to be Robin, but I didn't need that. Yeah. I really didn't need that. And it just seems so pandering and condescending. It's like, come on, who are you making this for? 6-year-olds? Maybe they were. I don't know. But yeah. I don't think so, because it, you know, it deals with a lot of heady issues that 6-year-olds aren't going to get. So it just felt really incongruous with the rest of it. One other thing I want to say is the animation style. Now, the first before the credit sequence, I was a little disappointed in the animation style. It seemed really, really basic to me. But then I saw these opening credits, and I love the artwork in the opening credits. And I was like, oh, man, I wish that the rest of the show could be like that. Well, after it got going, I noticed that they were using that art style for the backgrounds. Mm-hmm. So it was kind of, you know, it was, and I wish that they had put a little more detail into the characters. But, you know, I mean, it's...
Yeah.
For what it is, what it is, and for what it is, I enjoyed it, and I thought that the artistic choices were decent, but I would have liked to seen them spend a little more time and a little more effort in drawing the characters. I think that's about it.
All right.
Okay, guys.
This is going to be it.
You ready for me to zig when you thought I was going to zag?
Okay.
I like this film.
Huh?
I like this film.
No,
I wanted... No, I did. No, I really did. I think that the last 20 minutes of this film deserves a much better film to be in, because the last 20 minutes of this film is fantastic. Mm-hmm. I thought it was really, really good. And I actually did love the fight scene toward the end. That's when I was the most invested in it. When Batman versus the Red Hood, that was some great fight choreography. Mm-hmm. And I really thought they did a fantastic job of, you know, these two characters who have a massive amount of history behind them fighting one another. And it was tragic and fantastic. My thing is, everything up to that point did not fit with that last 20 minutes, because that last 20 minutes was a really, really good film. First part of this film, absolutely unearned. You cannot... The voice actor for the Joker is absolutely... the worst. That was awful. Come on, man. Oh, it was terrible. He was super dull. How can you make a Batman film and have the Joker be the most dull thing out of it? He was terrible. I could not believe.
Mm-mm.
Oh, God, yes.
You can kiss his shiny metal ass, let me tell you that.
Yeah, well, that's the thing is, I immediately, the very first thing I did after finishing this was go to IMDb just to find out. I'm like, God, what else has this guy done? And his IMDb page is prodigious. He has done so much voice work. It's amazing. I was absolutely floored to find that out, because I thought he was perfectly awful.
I thought he was awesome.
Oh, man. So dull.
Yeah, I love his deadpan approach, so.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know who this film was made for, because you start off with, you know, him beating a teenage boy with a crowbar. And I know that happened in the comics, and I know the history behind that, but I just felt like that was so unearned, just to just jump into that. And if you're going to beat someone with a crowbar, if you're going to have that be the foundation of your film, man, either go all out or don't do it. I mean, there's no blood. He didn't seem that injured. I mean, here he is absolutely wailing on him with a crowbar. Mm-hmm. And there's practically no damage. I mean, his little mask was slightly torn. That was the only sign that he was injured in any way whatsoever.
Yeah, that's what I would have to definitely agree with you. All the fight scenes on this, they were all edited to where no blood, no gore, no
fight.
Listen, if you're going to go there, go there.
Well,
own it.
Yeah.
Own that fact. If you're going to have the Joker beating teenage boy with a crowbar, you own that. You earn that. Don't just, you know, make it so tame that it doesn't mean anything. And in fact, that robs the entire rest of the film of its weight, because he didn't look that damaged anyway.
Oh,
come on, Tim. I mean, here we go. We start off the film with this beating followed by an explosion that was fairly large and, you know, it didn't absolutely decimate the building. So this explosion killed Robin. But the explosion at the end, which absolutely decimated the building they were in, didn't harm any of the three that were in there. I'm sorry, that is just
hilarious.
Completely.
It's like the Blues Brothers.
It really was. It was ludicrous. And that's what really irritates me, is because you had some great work going with Batman and the Red Hood and Nightwing. I tell you what, I would be so thrilled to watch a movie just featuring Batman and Nightwing. I thought the chemistry between Bruce Greenwood and Neil Patrick Harris was fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely phenomenal. But, man, yeah. I tell you, everything outside of that in the last 20 minutes was just a dud. But I really, really, I like this story. I think that, you know, it is very powerful, and it is one of the defining moments of Batman's life, the fact that he was unable to save him. And this movie just does not give it that proper weight. I mean, that should be really the lodestone around his neck, and I just don't feel like they gave it the weight that it deserved, and it deserves weight.
I think that maybe it still had the comics authority going on with that, trying to, because that's, you're right, every time they got almost really good and violent, it would cut back and you'd like, oh, okay, comic books, kids, you know.
Yeah, I mean, and
yeah,
this is really heavy stuff. I mean, I hate to sound like I'm harping on this, you're beating a teenage boy with a crowbar. That's not lightweight stuff, man. You've got to treat that with respect it deserves.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't do that. I'm sorry, they just did not. And those two explosions were a joke. I mean, I can't accept the fact that explosion at the end did absolutely no harm to anybody. And I know this is a comic book movie, but this was a serious subject matter. And I just thought they treated it way too lightly.
I get where you're coming from.
Well,
I do, and it did occur to me too. During that beating, that I would have liked at least seen a little bit of blood and maybe some bruising or, you know, something that showed that this is causing serious harm to this kid. And, you know, after the explosion, I would have really, you know, I was like, okay, that entire building is like in little bitty pieces. Yet, you know, there's not even any smoke damage onto his body. I would have seen at least a little, you know, like soot or something on the body when he found it. To show that he was in an explosion, but I do want to address your DiMaggio comment.
I'm not asking for a snuff film or anything, but you know, literally, if you go back and look at the artwork from the comic book where this originated, it was horrific. I mean, they showed him just absolutely beaten to a bloody pulp, and you know, that's serious stuff. And really, this whole notion, you mentioned, you know, the characters coming back from the grave and that being a comic book staple. Yeah, I agree. That's a real problem. It doesn't carry enough weight. And I honestly think it would be a great thing for Marvel and DC as comic book publishers to say, okay, look, this is it. From now on, if you as a creator kill a character, that's fine. That character is dead. And if you want to bring them back to life, you have to earn that. You have to work seriously hard to earn that. Otherwise, that character stays dead. I feel like if a creator kills off a character, they should have to convince the publisher to bring them back to life. They shouldn't get a free pass. Just death shouldn't be a revolving door.
That's right. You're not seeing Ned Stark coming back anytime soon.
No.
But I did want to say what you were saying about the Joker's voice. Okay, now during the first when the Joker first came on and he started speaking, I was a little taken aback because his Joker was so different from any other Joker I've ever heard. Every other performance of the Joker they play this maniacal goofiness through the entire character. Every other portrayal of the Joker is just, you know, they're playing the insanity 120% of the time. What he was doing was, I really respected, because it took me by surprise, because he starts off sounding very sane and very, very ominous. And then, but he breaks into this insane laughter and cackle at selected moments. And it was, now, you know, whether or not that works for you is I think a personal thing, but I really appreciated that they were doing a different take on the Joker. And I was thinking of the Joker in a very different way than I had previously, because I was like, okay, he has these moments where he thinks very crystal clear and can, and it explains a lot, because the Joker has these extremely elaborate plans that depend upon very detailed things happening at very specific times. Now, someone who is completely off their rocker 100% of the time would not have the attention span or the attention to detail to be able to pull that off. Someone who flips back and forth between these moments of complete anarchy and insanity to these crystalline moments to where they can actually concentrate on planning something like that really seems to fit more in with the Joker that we see, you know, in these comics and in these stories. But anyway, that was the way I saw it.
I think that that's a perfectly valid approach to the Joker. What I'm saying is this Joker sounded and behaved more like generic henchman number 3. I mean, he did not. There was nothing iconic about this performance. And I think the gold standard is Mark Hamill. I mean, absolutely, 100% the gold standard for as far as vocal work. His Joker does all the things that you're talking about. He does, you know, at times sound completely straight and normal, and then at other times he's complete lunatic. And he walks that line, and it fully embodies both sides of it. This voice actor, I mean, it was just absolutely without any kind of personality or charm whatsoever. And then every once in a while would remember, oh, I'm supposed to be the Joker, so I better throw in the laugh and do something kind of antic. But most of the time, I mean, it was just gravel voiced henchman number 4.
I'm not going to agree with it, but I like your opinion more.
I loved, yeah, exactly.
Having said that, though, I mean, I appreciated the story they were trying to tell. I really feel like this story, unless you are really supremely talented as a writer, you're not going to tell this story in one movie. I mean, and a short movie at that. This wasn't even, you know, an hour and 45 minutes 2-hour film. I mean, this was barely over an hour.
Yeah.
And man, this is a huge story to try to cram into such a small amount of time. And it showed. I mean, you just did not get the weight of the story that they were trying to tell. This is a story that deserves maybe a half dozen episodes of a TV show. Yeah. This is something that could have been told as part of Batman, the animated series, which is far superior to this.
Well, I do have to say one thing. This movie right here also, well, for me, it proved that DC, because there's a couple others, Justice League movies that I've seen, animated movies. DC in the animated movie world, they've got it. They've got them hooked. I mean, there's no, if you want an animated superhero movie, you're going to get DC, because these guys know how to do it. They're doing it right. Now, you're right. Sure, we'll nitpick this one, but I will tell you, this is a great representative of how great DC animated movies are. And I wish Marvel would do them.
Oh, so the Marvel animated movies aren't great?
I haven't liked any of them.
I haven't watched them.
The only Marvel animated thing that I've really loved was the Avengers Earth's Mightiest Heroes TV series that lasted for 2 years and was phenomenal. Like, for me as a lifelong Marvel zombie, that hit so many sweet spots and had such smart characterization. Mm-hmm. And it just really was animated by complete love of and understanding of what makes Marvel Comics great and what makes the Marvel Universe an exciting place to play. So I totally recommend that show. But as far as their movies go, I think the best they've done is the Hulk versus, which was like Hulk versus Wolverine is really good.
Yeah.
And Hulk versus Thor is pretty good. Mm-hmm. But that's about it.
Yeah, the Hulk versus Wolverine's awesome because it's got Deadpool in it.
Is Earth's Mightiest Heroes, is that available on Netflix, or where would I see that?
It is.
Okay.
It's on Netflix.
Because this was actually, I have to admit, I'm going to get pounded here by all the nerds, but this was the first animated comic book feature I think I've ever seen. And I liked it. And so I'm like, I'm now going to add this Earth's Mightiest Heroes to my Netflix queue. And if any of you guys have, like, you know, the best of the best that you want to suggest that I watch, you know, just send me an email or post on my Facebook, because I'm going to add these to my queue, and I'm going to, you know, I've got tons of stuff that I want to watch, but I'm going to pepper these in with my viewing and check them out, because, this was better than I expected it to be.
Have you seen Hulk Versus yet, Eric?
Good.
No, I haven't seen any of the animated.
Put that on your list, especially the Hulk versus Wolverine, like Tim was saying. It's some of the best, and that Hulk Versus is just really good. It's actually, I think, like 4 different episodes in it. I think that's what it comes out to. And it's really good. And one of them, I think, is actually taken from Wolverine the animated series, the recent animated series. But it's a really good collection.
Okay, I want to make one comment, which is that I want to point out that the Earth's Mightiest Heroes show is a kids. It's aimed at kids. It's not like grown up as Under the Red Hood is. But it's really fun, and it's smarter than you think. That's what I would say. If they'd had this when I was a kid, I would have been glued to it every week, reruns or no. And the other thing I want to say is that there is a Batman animated movie that I will actually say is probably, in terms of achievement, is a better movie than Under the Red Hood. I love Under the Red Hood more because of what a big, strange, weird movie it is and the things that it hits on that I already talked about to death. But I think it's streaming on Netflix. Batman Year One is a very faithful adaptation of Frank Miller's graphic novel, Batman Year One, which tells kind of the origin story. And it is, I don't know if any of you have seen it, but it's really, really, like, almost obsessively faithful. And as if all of this isn't good enough, young Jim Gordon, when he first moves to Gotham City and first learns his way around the city, is played by none other than Bryan Cranston.
Right. Yeah.
That's awesome.
The main character, he is as much the main character as Bruce Wayne is. So it's really a great movie.
Have you seen the Dark Knight animated movie they made? They did Dark 1 and 2.
Yeah.
That's another great. I mean, when I saw that come out, The Dark Knight.
Yeah.
And they stay absolutely true to the comic, the Frank Miller Dark Knight comic. And that's I loved it when it came out. And it's
is the animation style similar to the to what's in the comic?
Actually, in some scenes there are, and
it has to be simplified.
Yeah. There's some scenes where you're like, that's straight from the panel. I mean, you gotta see them quick, of course, since it's a moving thing. But yeah, there's parts that looks, hey, that's straight from one of the panels on page 17 or whatever, you know. So, but yeah, I think they do a really good job with it.
Yeah.
All right, I think we talked this to death. At least to a death that Ra's al Ghul might bring him back to life later on anyway. But I want to get me a Lazarus pit.
Yeah, where's that Lazarus water at?
I could use some of that too.
All right, well, actually, you know what?
I wanted to thank the three of you guys for actually taking the time to watch this movie, because it's a movie that I've watched and thought about a lot, for good and ill, you know, because again, I acknowledge that it's not perfect. I definitely like it more than Tim, but I find the movie so interesting that I'm glad I finally had somebody to talk to about it. So thanks, guys.
Well, now we have to find another one we can talk about together.
I do actually like it more than you think I do. I think part of the job of a critic is to take something that you actually like and critique it, to actually take the time to beat it up a little bit with a baseball bat, because, you know,
or a crowbar.
Or a crowbar. Yeah.
Or a crowbar. I mean,
that's the only way that, you know, something is going to get better is through honest critique. And, you know, I really wanted to see this story done properly and done really well, because I think this is, like I said, a defining moment in the character of Batman. And I just don't think they did it quite right. I want to see it done again. I want to see that story told in a way that I think is emotionally satisfying. And I just did not find this emotionally satisfying outside of the final kind of confrontation between the Red Hood and Batman. There was some serious emotion going on there. And I think that could provide a lot of catharsis. It could be very moving. This is a tragic story. I mean, Batman takes in this teenage boy
and ends up getting him killed or allowing him to be killed in the most brutal fashion. That's horrifying. And that would be something that, as Batman, that would absolutely be devastating and something that you do carry around every single minute of every day. And I think that we got really close to something quite good with the ending of this film. Yeah. And, you know, the reason I'm so harsh on it is because I really wanted it to be better, because I did actually find myself engaged by these characters at the end of the film.
Well, I figured out this way, that this film is the teenage boy. Tim Matson is the Crowbar. Tim Coker is the Joker that has launched this Crowbar towards this film. So we figured that out. All right, got it going. All right, let's end it on that positive note, that Tim actually likes it, but he loves beating it to death. Yeah.
I just want to say one more thing before we wrap this up. First of all, did you guys notice that when Batman first encounters Jason stealing the wheels from the Batmobile, what's in his hand?
A crowbar, yes. Or, well, a tire iron, but yeah.
Yeah. I thought that was interesting. Yeah. This has been something that has been brought up many, many times, and I'm not saying it's there or it's not there, but there's something about the relationship between Batman and Boy Robin that seems a little creepy to me, and always has and always will, and especially so in this movie.
Yeah.
Because he really is a kid, you know, a young kid, and especially wearing that kind of weird, those really tight shorts. I don't know what's up. I just thought it was a little creepy. I don't know what's up with that. But even aside from that, and this was probably addressed in other comics or other movies or whatever, but Batman allowing these young boys, as Robin, to go into these extremely dangerous situations where Batman's no fool. He knows what the consequences may be. But we didn't see him struggling with that decision in this movie at all, but maybe it's because it's already been done before and they didn't want to cover that territory. But it did, it very much ties in with the subject matter and the themes of this movie, the risk that he's putting these kids at and what the potential of that risk is and what the consequences of that outcome would be, that it seemed like a big gaping hole to me that they didn't address that issue. But
that's something we could spend an entire podcast discussing.
Exactly.
That's a major issue with the character that really is fascinating to me, what he's doing by taking these young boys under his wing and bringing them up in a world of violence, instead of, sending them to a good home or helping them find a family. I mean, he could have taken that young boy from the street and then, as Bruce Wayne, helped him find a good foster home, a mom and dad that loves him. But instead of doing that, he's taking him under his wing as Batman. And that's, something entirely different and fascinating.
Yeah,
I agree with Eric. It's a fascinating thing. But his motives are for doing that. It's something we could talk about for hours.
Yeah, definitely so. Well, we lost Tim Coker. He had to get on along and do some other things. But let's go ahead and – he didn't have a Twitter address anyway to give on the air, so we don't need him. So let's go ahead and close this out because, hey, there's lots more things we could talk about next time around. But in the meantime, let's go ahead and close out this week's Nerd Up podcast. I'll let you guys introduce yourself extraduce, I guess, is what it would be if you ask me. I always wanted to coin a phrase, and I think that's it. We're going to extraduce because it's the exit at the end of the podcast.
What you did there.
Yeah, see? So we'll extraduce ourselves and give our Twitter addresses so people can contact us and they can gripe, whatever, questions, answers, and we'll probably read your question on the podcast if you want us to. But I'm Gil T. Wilson. You can reach me at Gil Wilson. That's GILWILSON.
And I am Eric Billingsley's doppelganger, and you can reach me at Eric Bill, ERICBILL.
I am Tim Metzen's Outrage, and you can find me at Tim Gone Mad, TimGonMad.
And I want to close out one more thing here. Tim, one of the reasons I love to have you on this podcast is not because I joke about how cynical you are, but I love the fact that you can take yourself, no matter how much you enjoy something, and you said it perfectly earlier, you can take something and you can criticize the crap out of it just because you want to really fully explore it. And don't ever stop doing that, because I love that here on the podcast. So I just wanted to let you know that before we left.
Thank you. I think that that's some of the things that I love the most are some of the things you'll hear me bash the worst.
That's exactly. And so don't stop. So let's stop this podcast. I'm Guilty Wilson. Hey, stay nerdy. Nerd Up Podcast.
www.gilwilson.com. If you need quality voice work for your radio commercials, audio for TV commercials, or maybe just for that message on hold for your business, you need to check out
www.gilwilson.com.
GILWILSON.com. www.gilwilson.com. Check it out. It's quirky. It's fun. It's innovative.